Mini episode 81 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by First Down Scouting, delivering the most thorough scouting service available, uncovering the NFL stars of tomorrow. Follow them on the web at the number one, stdownscouting.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 81. This is FDH Lounge. Managing partner Rick Morris. We've got a very special treat for everybody here today. Going to be an excellent discussion. Really something that exemplifies what the FDH New York Bureau, our senior producer Steve Servillo, has been able to do with building the New York wing, if you will, of our FDH Lounge dignitary roster. It's great to be able to have on guys like the combination we had a couple weeks ago, Simon Applebaum and Lloyd Carroll. It's going to be great to get this gentleman on with us here. It's been way too long since we've been able to do this, but it's a tremendous pleasure getting to talk to him anytime, either on air or off air, and I feel like a real sense of validation for where we're going as an organization when we have a gentleman like this in the fold and somebody that we can consider part of the FDH Lounge family, because he brings a lot of insight to his discussions on TV and broader things, really, radio and pop culture and entertainment and other matters that he has covered over a period of time. He's gone from one major conglomerate to another, having made his bones as the longtime TV editor and lead TV columnist at the New York Post, having gone now from News Corp over to Comcast, from one giant to another. You can presently find his columns at the Xfinity site that Comcast has. The Xfinity TV blog in particular, xfinity.comcast.net, to find that specifically. You can also find, and we'll talk about this as well, his memoirs being at least partially serialized at adambuckman.com. TV Howl calls this gentleman the best TV columnist in America, and we concur. Our good friend, Adam Buckman, a pleasure to welcome to the show. Adam, good to have you on tonight, my friend. How are you?
I'm really great. That was so nice of you to say that stuff.
Thank you. Well, I really mean it. It's a pleasure to get to talk about these things with you. And again,
you're a gracious host. You've
done so much and been able to cover so much in the course of your career. And I know we'll touch on that a little bit with the memoirs project that you've got going there, because I find it fascinating. But one of the probably logical places to start, when you were on previously, and I should reference that your previous appearance is now up at the FDH Lounge Multimedia Magazine, the fdhlounge.blogspot.com. People can check that out. We got that up there just in the last 24 hours. But that discussion, you and I had a really good in-depth kind of attempt to make sense of things after the Michael Jackson Memorial Service and weeks of coverage. And it's a very sad coincidence, Adam, that as we're talking again here today, it's on the heels of Whitney Houston and all the coverage of the last couple of days, starting with everything the first night, and the Grammys, of course, Sunday night, you know, everything that transpired there with the tribute to her. And, you know, people are going to find commonalities in the situation between her and MJ, but it's a thing where beyond the surface of it, that they were two of the biggest selling artists of all time, beyond the drugs, it seems like there's a real commonality to me, Adam, in terms of this whole concept that's as old as time itself of the fall from grace. I mean, when she was first coming up, you know, and I say this as somebody who's not a big pop music person, I'm more so into rock, but how could you not respect the voice and the class and the beauty and the elegance? And I mean, I would say without any sense of irony whatsoever that she really came across like a princess to me. I say that admiringly, and I don't mean to say anything ill of the dead, but just in walking past the tabloids in recent years, I just look at it and I shake my head like, wow, what the hell happened to you? You know, so it seems to me like there's a lot of rubbernecking among all of us that have watched this woman really kind of tumble over the last 15 to 20 years.
It's true, and like you know, I consume the media, you know, and you watch all the news reports have been everywhere the last couple of days, and like you said, for years her escapades, photographs of her not looking so well after a night of partying or perhaps getting in a physical situation with her ex-husband, whatever it was. You know, you'd kind of sit back, stand back and say, what's really going on there? Because we all know that as invasive as the media is, it doesn't give anyone a complete picture of anything. So what I'm always curious about is, what's the real deal in her inner circle? Or what's the real deal when she's at home alone or with one other assistant or something at home where it's allegedly safe? And I bring this up because, you know, she died in a hotel bathtub when there were apparently other people in her retinue. Maybe she has assistants or something, or makeup people or whatever, who were just in the other room. And apparently she may have said to them, I'm going to go soak in a hot tub, and I'm just going to go and relax. Somehow, she passed out, fell asleep, or otherwise became unconscious and slipped under the water. You know, I mean, you just wonder why that would occur if there's people around. And what is the life of these people anyway? I had the same kind of thoughts when Michael Jackson died because, you know, that story came out of an environment that most of us can't imagine. Not only that huge rented mansion that he had, but whatever setup he had arranged to have a full-time physician administering to him at his request, you know, operating room level anesthesia. You know, I mean, it just boggles the mind. So I often don't know what to think. And I think what happens is we're left with the voice and the way we felt when we heard their music on the radio or when we were at a formative age. Because in the end, there's not anyone in America who probably didn't think Michael Jackson was in some ways, to put it bluntly, kind of a weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it was very easy to cry and be very sad when he died. Because the music he made was some of the best music we heard in all of our lives. And for many people, not me, like you, my personal taste runs different than the Whitney Houston music, but but you know, mad respect for her talent and for her impact in the culture. And I think there's two personalities. There's that very private one where they're lonely, maybe they're longing for the spotlight all the time and need to medicate to get over it when they're in private, or maybe they need to medicate because the spotlight is in fact too much for them. And then there's that public persona where they make the greatest music you ever heard in your life and put on the most electrifying shows you ever heard. And this has been going on since Judy Garland and just everybody who, and even earlier last year, Amy Winehouse, huge, huge talents that I think are conflicted inside, in which they like being out in public, but I think it pains them in some way too, and they wind up becoming dependent on substances.
It's replicated itself with other great talents, and
for years.
A little similar to when you and I were talking after Jacko, as far as the whole thing about the sadness that people are feeling. Maybe it's less so for themselves, more so the sense of nostalgia, like we're losing a piece of ourselves. With that music and where we were when we heard it. And you know, there's just another aspect of this too, Adam, and I don't think it'll ever resolve itself as far as a right or a wrong answer, what we think about these things. But, you know, in looking at her and everything, and I spoke of that image that she had, and somebody who came up, singing some gospel and, you know, being sort of royalty in the business because of her mom and some of the other connections around her.
And everything
that she portrayed, you know, such a really pure kind of wholesome image, and it was easy to buy into that. And I'll always maintain that even if something ends up being not exactly the truth, shall we say, it always comes from a kernel. It always comes from a glimmer that's real. There was something that we saw in her that did exemplify that, but at a point in time, it really comes to be, I don't know if it's fair to say resentment or whatever, but like I said, that whole just sort of revulsion at walking past the tabloids and seeing her on there, you know, that is it completely fair that the image that's packaged of these people that's put out there, that clearly in her case was not 100% true, shall we say, is it fair to resent them for not living up to that? It's one of those things. I mean, that image made her a wealthy woman. That image gave her everything that she had.
Yes.
But I guess you could say for better and for worse.
It's a very, very interesting question you raise. I mean, you know, should they just be honest and let it all hang out, or you know, with the aid and with the aid of their record companies and publicists, is it better for them in the long run to lead this sort of sad and addicted life in private and to as much as they can, which they really can't today that much anyway, but as much as they can, put out a public image that everything's great in their lives? Because the truth is, and I'm no psychologist, but it could be that having to balance the two is what wrecks some of their personalities in the first place. You know, maybe it feels hypocritical to be suffering on the inside, but then having to go out on stage and put on a boffo show all the time. You know, I just think that's probably the kind of bargain with the devil that some people in showbiz have to make. You know, the show has to go on. I'm so always fascinated sometimes, for example, with the late night TV hosts who are on really almost every night except for a couple of weeks off. And you have a guy like Letterman who had to come on one night and admit that he was sleeping with one or maybe more of his interns or young women who work with him. And so you figured, okay, if he's saying that in public, then his own marriage that he's currently in must be a disaster in his private life, okay? And yet, comes on night after night after that, doing top 10 lists and joking around with Paul. I mean, it's show business, and show business, if nothing else, is artifice, I suppose. And it's supposed to make, you know, the person who pays for the tickets feel good, not necessarily the person putting on the show, you know. And I guess people in showbiz, you know, they might be frowning backstage, but when the lights go on and they got to go out there and the curtain opens, you know, it's big smiles to everybody. And that's just the way that they wind up living their lives. They live their
lives.
That's
a very real duality, no question about it. And it ends up being a bigger lie for some people than for others.
Yes.
You know, since you mentioned Letterman, let's get to that part of the discussion here. Because, again, as we were talking about at the outset, AdamBuchman.com, you've got a partial serialization as things are going on of your memoirs. I have to give you credit. As I was listening to our past discussion as far as the late-night hosts, your time, obviously, at the New York Post that you spent really covering the Battle of the 90s close-up, you had a real good feel for the whole thing. And you said the last time we talked that you didn't see any reason, this was right as Leno was about to begin the 10 o'clock show, that you didn't see any reason for him to have been deposed in the first place from the Tonight Show. And, you know, history has borne out your point of view on that. The insights that you developed in covering that beat served you real well on that call because, you know, he's back and it's like he never left in a lot of ways.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I could probably cite you examples where my guesses or my prognostications were not quite as accurate, but it is true that you cover an industry, a single industry, long enough, and I've been covering television pretty much since 1983. You do begin to develop instincts about the patterns of the way things work, and you know it was drummed into me from an early age from people who had been in the television business for decades that ultimately it comes down to the audience you can attract and the money you can get for that audience from people who buy the commercial time, you know? So if you have a guy leading late-night TV and you're getting ready to remove him from that show, like they were getting ready for 5 years to remove Leno because they promised it to Conan, and yet 5 years went by and Leno was still having the biggest audience in late-night, and then they went ahead and removed him, I immediately thought to myself, that just goes against very, very basic logic, the logic under which the television business has long operated. It's almost like if you're Isaac Newton and you're observing, like instead of the apple falling from the tree, it like fell upwards or something. It just wouldn't be a law that you could kind of tolerate if it were the opposite to what you knew to be true. And so I that's a complicated way of saying, what are they getting rid of Leno for? You know, you're supposed to wait until the ratings stink, and then you get rid of them. You know, it's just show business. And to promise it to Conan because Conan's feelings would have been hurt or something in the years, if years and years went by and Leno remained in the job till he was 80, you know, and Conan would have gotten all miffed and gone to another network. Well, my feeling always was, let them go. Let that scenario take care of itself at that time. You know, they were afraid that someday, well, here's what would happen. Leno would stay, and he'd be their aging guy. And then Letterman, who's a few years older than Leno, would retire. And Conan would become the 11:30 guy at CBS up against NBC, representing a slightly younger audience that he would have brought over from, you know, NBC late night, you know, the 12:30. And I guess that may have happened, but I don't think you can control what's going to happen in the future. I think you have to deal with what you're dealing with at the moment. And I always thought that was, I always thought there was just something wrong with promising Conan something as if show business had anything to do with a person's feelings, you know, which it doesn't.
No, it clearly does not. The thing, one of the things that I found to be very entertaining as I've been going through this memoir in progress entitled "Jerk: My Life as a Columnist on the TV Beat," I like the way that you've really kind of come clean and laid it out there about what it's like to have that post at a tabloid newspaper that quite frankly is not afraid to interject itself and become part of the story. And
yeah,
you went through in particular when you were talking about the stuff with Letterman, and for anybody like myself that didn't grow up in the New York area or live there or get to read this as it was happening, it was great to be able to, I mean, I was just laughing out loud at some of this stuff as you are openly admitting and talking about these things. Well, I did this here, we were pushing Dave's buttons on that, and you know, I think we got the reaction we were looking for at this point in time. It was just really great stuff and very entertaining, you know, to see how your columns and how your coverage ultimately became part of the story.
I appreciate that a lot. And Rick, you are one of the up to two or three people that find that that website every day, and most of whom leave immediately. But
we're going to pump up that number, Adam.
Well, I'm delighted that you read that. I don't want to make a huge speech about my autobiography, but this began as a way of trying to make sense of a career that, when I left the Post, and I will say right here, I was fired from the Post, and I won't go into why, but I spent some time personally trying to take stock of where I'd been for the past almost three decades covering television. And frankly, at the time, with little else to do, I thought, let me take stock of the resources and archival material that I kept. And I kept stories, I kept some interviews, I kept clippings, whatever, you know, and try to sort of organize it and make sense. And one of the stories that you talk about is a battle we had with David Letterman's show back in the 90s when, honestly, his press people and his producer wouldn't give us the time of day, and so we reigned all over him in print. I mean, you know, and journalists, classically speaking, are not supposed to go around admitting that they had it in for somebody, you know? But I don't want to be a hypocrite, particularly because in the beginning, the project known as Jerk, in which I portray myself as a jerk at times, and that's why it's titled that way, was really about me trying to make sense of some of the stuff I pulled when I was covering television at the New York Post. And in the end, I thought, let me throw it up on a website. Frankly, I'd like to get more people to read it, and I always like to have more writing samples online for job prospecting and stuff like that, because we're always on the lookout for stuff like that, writing assignments and whatnot. And here was something that I happened to, at least at the very least, liked the writing of. I think the writing was good. I mean, I'm a pretty modest guy when it comes to that stuff and very self-critical, Rick, but even I like how I did that thing. And so there's some great stories on there, some sort of mixing it up with Letterman, with Seinfeld, with Leno, with William Shatner, how it is day to day when you're covering television and you find yourself interviewing this one or interviewing that one, and they're from very different spectrums, very different portions of the TV business, running the gamut from crazy daytime shows to primetime shows to late night and news and all the kind of weird and crazy people that you meet, and how readers react to you. And as you know, that's a big part of this work too, was to sort of put into perspective what it was like to feel like you were in a war with readers all the time, you know.
Well, I think that part of it, yeah, I mean, the concept of a war with readers is something that people would have to kind of take a minute to wrap their minds around, but you describe it very well. I think also, too, something that I found really just in the last 24 hours that was very interesting was a theory that was floated to me as I had emailed to you, that one of our main contributors on the show here, who's a big Howard Stern freak and has followed him over the years, this sense that he has, because you detail in the book, and Howard didn't like some of the stuff you wrote. He thought you were prejudging his TV show and some of this stuff here. But
yes, there's a whole
chapter on it. It's very interesting that our guy who listens to Howard a lot thinks it comes from a wounded place of Howard going, boy, this Adam really knows a lot about TV. I wish this guy regarded me a little higher. That had to be an interesting thing for you to hear.
You mean Howard said that?
Well, our correspondent's reading between the lines here. He's psychoanalyzing and reading between the lines. So I'm not going to say that he's ever said that, mind you.
Okay.
But this sense that it seems very transparent. And a lot of Howard stuff, frankly, is transparent. When he's got grudges against somebody, when he's got an agenda, a lot of it is pretty transparent. And so apparently if you're listening to how he talks about you or has, you know, previously, a lot of it sounds like it's coming from kind of a spurned place. Like, gee, this guy who knows a lot about TV and radio, I wish he wouldn't beat up on me so much.
That's very interesting. And that's also, and I'll tell you why it's kind of flattering. Not because Howard does or does not care what Adam Buckman thinks of him, et cetera. It's this. In writing this material, I did what I always do, because I do take some pride in journalism, Rick. And and in the case of that particular chapter, what it is, it's a whole chapter of three or four kind of separate incidents where I wrote about Howard Stern and he commented bitterly or otherwise about it on his radio show. And these incidents happened during the 90s when he had various notorious television shows, such as a very notorious pay-per-view New Year's Eve special that many people will remember or at least try to forget.
Yeah, but Bongo Fiesta.
Exactly. And the way I wrote it was to just say, you know what, without giving my opinion, although it's sort of in there a little bit, I'm going to tell it as factually as I can in kind of a chronology here. And what I like about that person's reaction is that it's a reaction and an interpretation that I did not perceive, but that is nevertheless valid, given the way that the material is written. And what I mean by that is when you write neutrally, when journalism really works well, it can be very entertaining and very sprightly to read. But if it's very factual, like I hope that was, it is then open to different points of view and interpretation about what's going on, as you say, between the lines. And I'm kind of flattered to get a reaction like that, because it means that the reader read it and kind of digested it in a personal way and had his own interpretation of it. And that's very interesting. I have no idea if that's how Howard felt or not. I think that person's observation sounds well informed, and it could very well be a very perceptive perception about how Howard felt when he read those things. You know, as I think I bring out in that part of the work, is that I didn't care that much how he felt about it. I just really wanted to get mentioned on his show and get talked about on a show and get in good with my editors, because they would have been aware of that too. And again, that's sort of the underlying theme of the whole book, how journalism isn't always journalism. There's sometimes other motivations at work.
Yeah, and the honesty really brings that across, no question about that. In our few minutes remaining here, I want to get to some headlines with the present TV scene that you are currently covering for Xfinity, among other outlets. Mm-hmm. You had emailed me, this was very interesting, this afternoon, about the numbers coming in. We had talked yesterday off air about Smash. How was that going to come out? I think you indicated yesterday you had a little bit of a sense that there might be an issue there.
Yeah.
According to your email, they lost a third of the audience in their second week last night, actually. So
yes.
That's pretty brutal when you take into consideration how much it was plugged on the Super Bowl and really the hopes of a network behind it. There've got to be some real hanging heads over at the Peacock folks right about now.
Here again, as a journalist, because I have no stake in whether it does well or doesn't do well. For a journalist covering television, if Smash becomes a smash hit, that's a good story. If it begins to drift off and drift down and not succeed, that's a good story too. I have no animus against the show. But I also can invoke now what I said earlier about certain laws being more or less or almost always absolute in television. And when you launch a new show with so much hype and so much pre-publicity, look not only the commercial time they devoted to it in their own Super Bowl before 111 million people. They had been promoting this thing for weeks and even saying publicly they wanted it to help save the entire network and things like that. So it gets 11.5 million people to watch it the day after the Super Bowl, and that's not really as good as they had hoped. And then it slips to 8 million in its second outing. This is where I invoke another law that I've observed in television, is that when new shows like that, with all the attention paid to them, decline in their second week, it means, and I know this is tough for people, I mean, I don't know if anyone from NBC is listening to this or will listen to it, but, you know, the fact is it's not going to suddenly turn around and come back. It just isn't. Now, once in a blue moon, there are exceptions to that law, but it's more or less an absolute that unless it had gone up or stayed the same in its second week, it's not going to go any higher than the 8 million that it got this week. Here's another immodest thing I'll say, Rick. When this thing was coming up to air before it premiered, a few weeks before it premiered, I never wrote this, but I thought it in my head, and people are just going to have to believe me. I thought, this show is an 8 million viewer show. I just had this crazy instinct and so when it came out with 11.5 million the day after the Super Bowl, I thought, well, I'm glad for them. You know, it looks like the Super Bowl got it up higher than I thought it would be. And then lo and behold, in week two, 29% of the people who sampled it in week one did not return. And it became an 8 million viewer show, which isn't bad for NBC these days. But if it were on CBS, it'd probably be canceled in the second week because it'd be the lowest rated show on the network. So wait and see. Maybe something will happen that I can't foresee that'll make the show suddenly bloom and be popular. But I have a feeling it's not going to be the answer for NBC.
Interesting. Water finding its own level. We've got about a minute or so remaining here, Adam.
Just like to ask
you a quick thought on something that our friend Simon Applebaum had said a couple weeks ago when he was on the show. New Girl, which I've been a fan of on Fox here, he said that they were brutalized by the World Series break there and coming back afterwards. Has that continued to drop off? Because it was getting billed as one of the few new hits of the season back in September, but is it looking a lot bleaker at this point?
I think the drop-off ended, but I think there again, and you know what, off the top of my head, I can't remember what it has been kind of sort of averaging, but maybe it's been anywhere from 6 to 8 million itself, maybe less. It seems to me that there's a show where ratings won't be the only factor in whether it gets picked up or not. I think it's the kind of show that has just enough interest in the pop culture, frankly, because of Zooey Deschanel, that it will get picked up for a second season. I mean, Simon is right in the sense that it probably didn't achieve the high ratings that they hoped it would. Whether or not it got disrupted by the World Series, that's something that afflicts Fox almost every year, and I don't really have an eye on whether that really does damage of a permanent nature to the lineup. If anything, the show that did worse for Fox, I think, as far as its expectations went, was The X Factor during the fall season for them. It just didn't do what Simon Cowell bragged it would do. Zooey Deschanel was the guest host of Saturday Night Live last Saturday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she really made a believer out of me. I mean, I really hadn't really thought much about her. But she had great comedy chops on that show, and I'm not usually a particular fan of SNL, but everything she did was fantastic in it. And so I think she's one of these young Lucys, you know what I mean? She's one of these people who really could be a great TV comedian. And I think Fox probably understands this and will give her at least one more season to try that out. I don't think it'll end, in a couple of weeks when we start to hear about the new shows for fall.
Well, I'm hopeful of that. I'm a fan, and I'm hopeful that it'll go well. But, Adam, again, always a pleasure to have you on. Of course, the memoirs are being serialized at adambuckman.com, the blog over at tvhowl.com, and at the Xfinity coverage, xfinity.comcast.net, with all the columns that are there. Adam, a true pleasure. The time slipped by real fast.
Love to do
it again sometime soon, my friend.
Anytime, Rick. Thanks so much.
A real pleasure. Thanks very much. Our friend Adam Buckman, everybody. Pleasure to have him on. FDH Lounge, mini episode number 81. Thanks for tuning in.